the views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Thank you, Jason. And joining us today in the WVUD studios for Campus Voices, we've got two people from the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environments. John Cohen, an assistant professor of marine biosciences, and Chris Patron, a marine advisory service agent. We all know what professors do, but Chris, what the heck does a marine advisory service agent do?
So, akin to the land grant system is the sea grant system. And so it's a series of offices in most coastal states, Great Lakes, Puerto Rico. And within each sea grant office, there's usually a marine advisory component that does work with coastal stakeholders, whether that be fishermen, recreational commercial fishermen, dock handlers, boat handlers, charter captains, folks that, you know, that work in coastal industries like tourism, and then there's the K-12 component that I work in.
When you say stakeholders, do you mean ordinary people like me who live in Delaware?
Absolutely. Delaware is a coastal state, so and it's such a small coastal state that we are able to reach pretty much the whole state with our programs.
Well, John Cohen, you don't confine your research to Delaware, do you?
No. So it's really the questions that drive where the work gets done. And so we have projects that my lab does in Delaware Bay. We've got other projects right now going on in the Arctic, where we're interested in trying to understand the winter time in the Arctic, where it's kind of cold and it's very dark. And we want to know how much light there is in the Arctic in the winter, because it turns out that the organisms that live in the Arctic in the winter can probably use some of the light that is available. Even though it appears dark to us, it might not be totally dark to them. So we're trying to understand the light and how their eyes detect it.
Now, you work mostly with little creatures that live in the ocean. So you must be doing that in collaboration with some people who look at the big animals that walk around on top of the ice.
Sure. So the project that we're involved in the Arctic is really spans multiple trophic levels. So the little microbes all the way up to seabirds. And so those organisms are very connected to one another. So the organisms I work on, these little zooplankton, which are about the size of a grain of rice, eat the phytoplankton, the plant-like organisms, as well as microbes. And then the zooplankton, again, that I work on are eaten by fish and birds. And so we have people from all over the world, actually, a lot of Norwegian collaborators and Russian collaborators working on these other trophic levels, both lower and higher from the zooplankton. So we can really try to understand the food web and how these interactions are affected by climate change.
Understanding the food web is pretty important, I think, in terms of just overall understanding of the environment.
Sure. And so there are a lot of dependencies between species. And it's important when you think about the environment to think about it over seasons and then over years. And so I think that's one thing that we're really trying to do in the science that's happening now, is to really try to understand not just sort of the interaction between this species and this species, who eats who, but really how those interactions change with climate and with weather conditions, and then how again, climate change is affecting that.
Now, this interview is going to air for the first time the day after Earth Day 2015. So, Chris, I think all the stuff that John's talking about, that's pretty important to an understanding of how we ordinary persons interact with the environment.
Absolutely. And it's sort of my job to take a lot of the science that John and other scientists within the college do and really scale it back and talk about how does it affect the Joe public out there? What can they do to help the system, such as Earth Day and things like that, to improve sort of what we've broken? And so taking John's information from, the Arctic sea web, food web, and really harnessing it as a teaching tool for kindergartners through, undergraduates.
So many of our behaviors vis-a-vis the environment really are learned. We are still learning how to recycle our trash.
Yeah, it's my 4-year-old is all about recycling, and he just wants to throw stuff in cans, really. But when you direct him a little bit and say that's where this needs to go because it's going to get used again, he picks up on that, and so he runs with it a little bit.
But I think that's very important in terms of the ocean too. That people understand you don't just, if you're out fishing, toss your cigarette butts out into the water.
Absolutely, and it's a huge problem right now is marine debris. So there's all sorts of activities that people can get involved in terms of coastal cleanups and things like that. And just walking down the street, you see a piece of trash, take precautions and pick it up and put it in the trash can where it belongs. You can find all sorts of statistics on the amount of stuff that we find in the ocean and even on the beach and streams, rivers. So it's not just an ocean problem. It's very much a local problem as well.
We have a class yesterday just out on the Delaware Bay collecting zooplankton as part of a field course for a field trip for this course. And one of the first things that we looked at when we actually saw the plankton sample was plastic all over the surface of the sample. And so, even just routine collections of what you would think would be relatively healthy water are really have this plastic debris. So it's something that's definitely on our radar of what to look for.
That's interesting that you say that, because to me, I think of plastic. I think, the big danger is, make sure you break up your action goggles before you throw them out, because they might end up in the water and an animal might get caught. But you're talking about little tiny pieces of plastic.
Sure, and it's a lot of the little things you might not think of. Imagine the little plastic ring on a soda bottle just beneath the cap that kind of splits as you open the soda bottle. If that thing breaks up into 4 or 5 pieces, there are lots of those things floating around that we see. Monofilament line that just, it happens to be sort of blown off the boat or the dock or whatever it is, gets worn down. And so you see lots of little pieces of monofilament line. And so it's an issue.
How do your favorite creatures, the little zooplankton, deal with these little tiny pieces of plastic?
Yeah, if they're very small, there's been some suggestion that they ingest them. They eat the little pieces because it's about the size of their food. Oftentimes the pieces are about their size. And so presumably they just sort of interact with them, realize that it's not what they want to be near, and they deflect it. They're actually very good at creating water currents around themselves. And so what the organisms do, because they're really confined to a little water drop, they're really small creatures, and they're swimming in an environment which to them is like molasses to us. So we're large and we sort of can move through our fluid environment. These animals are really small. And so it's a very sticky water to them. And so they deal with that by creating a water current around themselves and can really feel and sense the particles that they come into contact with.
Now, some of your colleagues have been in here from the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment, and they talk about things like the life cycle of insects that migrate and the number of generations they go through in a year. Mm-hmm. What's the life cycle like for these little zooplankton?
Yeah, it's really important to think about them as life cycles, because that is indeed what they are. They're not just adults. And so there are sort of two types of zooplankton, some that live their entire lives in the plankton, and their life cycle might be a few weeks to a month. And they might have a few stages during the year and then form resting cysts that go into the sediments. And then they pop back up again in the spring when there's lots of food available, have another few generations, and then form resting cysts again. Or they might be something which we call meroplankton, which spend just a fraction of their life in the plankton. So this might be something like a blue crab that you would eat in the summertime. They mate and produce larvae that spend about a month in the plankton going through several stages, and then they settle and become the adult crab that you would think of. And then it takes about a year to get to a harvestable size.
Well, time out. You're saying in the plankton, and to me, an English major happens to work in a computing center. That doesn't make sense, because I thought the plankton was what you use to describe these creatures.
Sure. So the term plankton is really in reference to their ability to swim against horizontal currents. And so a whole variety of organisms from a whole suite of size scales would be considered plankton, from these little sort of rice-sized crustaceans or crab-like organisms, shrimp-like organisms, to Portuguese man-of-war jellyfish, which can be meters long. And so those are all considered plankton because of their inability to make much progress horizontally against a current. But they can migrate vertically to a really large extent. And so they might be able to swim fairly well vertically, but against horizontal currents, not so much.
So the way they get around is they swim up and down and let a current take them someplace else.
Exactly. Sometimes at the mercy of the current and sometimes very purposefully. So a species of crab larvae, for example, that wants to stay in the estuary, Delaware Bay, one of the mud crabs that we look at, it does this very, very well. It uses those currents as a little conveyor belt to maintain itself in the bay because currents tend to be at the surface, sort of net going out of the estuary and near the bottom, net going into the estuary. And they take advantage of that.
Chris, John's got me totally fascinated. Is this something that, like, when you go to schools and things, that the kids really groove on to? I mean, looking at zooplankton in a microscope and then seeing how they work. And
so, you know, zooplankton on the surface, are people think they're boring. It's, you know, they're just out there doing their thing. But when you start to really zoom in and look at these things for what they are, it's a pretty incredible little world that's going on around you. And I like to tell people that, you know, I do various programs with all sorts of audiences, and I usually try to pull in plankton in some way. And that can sometimes involve actually taking a plankton toe and then putting it under a scope and showing people. And I've ruined swimming in the ocean for countless people because they have no idea that these things are out. They have a general idea, but they don't, you know, they think of fish and whales and sharks out in the ocean, and as long as you stay near the beach, you're good. These things are everywhere. I mean, they're from the copepods that John works on to crab larvae to all sorts of things are in there swimming around with you, and they don't really know that. And so once you start to introduce that idea and then show on a sort of a big screen, a sample under the scope, people are amazed at what's swimming around with them in the ocean and bay.
Do you think that helps kind of communicate the Earth Day message that we need to be responsible for our environment? I mean, heck, they didn't know there's these little critters out there.
That's exactly right. And that knowledge is very important because once you see these things under the scope and on this big screen, you start to identify a little bit. You say, geez, I didn't know this was there. Maybe my impact on land can really affect, you know, these tiny critters that are out in the water.
You've also done some things, John, with deep sea creatures. Tell us about that.
Sure. So I spent, actually, before coming to Delaware, I got involved with using deep sea submersibles to collect organisms from about 1,500 feet beneath the surface. We would take a submersible and we would use suction samplers to suck up organisms, little crabs, and I worked a lot with shrimp, again, shrimp-like zooplankton that we would collect, and we would look at how they used bioluminescence or biologically produced light to communicate with one another, what wavelengths of light their eyes could see, and what purpose that light served ecologically. And interestingly, those same themes we are actually working on in the Arctic, where we're quantifying some of those same parameters. So that's sort of a something that's continued. And now we're sort of thinking about the winter Arctic as a deep sea analog. And so so the work in the deep sea is actually sort of making its way back and as a way to interpret some of what we're seeing in the wintertime Arctic, which is really a deep sea-like place.
Because it's dark and it's cold.
Exactly.
But it doesn't quite have the same pressure.
Right. And it turns out pressure doesn't matter below about 1,000 meters. And so when you're shallower than that, a lot of these organisms, getting back to your question about sort of what plankton means, they're vertically migrating. And so they're used to dealing with a huge pressure range. And so for organisms in the upper part of the deep sea, those organisms actually make their way into the shallow oceans really regularly.
Something us humans can't do. Got the bends if you come up too fast.
Right. It's amazing. I mean, the way they do it is they don't really have air-filled spaces. And so by getting rid of air-filled spaces, if they had something that could be air-filled, they fill it with oil or various things.
And so there's no nitrogen poisoning.
Yeah, so you don't have that issue.
I think all this stuff is absolutely fascinating. We've got John Cohen, an assistant professor of marine biosciences, and Chris Petrone, a marine advisory service agent, sort of the marine equivalent of an extension agent, if you will, from the College of Ag and Natural Resources. And they're here chatting with us today about almost like our relationship with these creatures in the ocean.
Yeah. I think the one thing that Chris and I have been working on most recently has been a project that's funded by Delaware Sea Grant, and that's really sort of bringing these ideas of these marine zooplankton to Delaware Bay. And it occurred a few years ago to me that no one has really looked at zooplankton in Delaware Bay in a sort of a holistic sense since the 1950s. And so it gave us a great opportunity to sort of combine our efforts in studying zooplankton with Chris's interests in using zooplankton as an educational tool. in this current project through Delaware Sea Grant. And it's been great. We've sort of been sampling the Delaware Bay quarterly, so we get a seasonal picture of zooplankton. And we're using a boat that was named after the person who actually conducted the 1950s zooplankton study, which was Complete Serendipity. So we're really excited about that project.
And the name of that new boat is?
The RV Joanne Daber. And so Joanne Daber was a member of the Marine Science Program in its very early days. And the program at that time was tasked with trying to understand Delaware Bay at a time when there was a fair amount of pollution coming from the upstream major metropolitan areas, and to really understand how that translated into fisheries impacts. And so what we're doing now is recreating that study 50 years later and trying to see how the changes in the Upper Bay, which has gotten a fair amount healthier,
really
have translated into changes in the plankton, or if they have at all. So that's what we're working on.
I would have thought with all those refineries up there that might still be an issue.
Yeah, I think in the 50s there was a time of a fair amount of unmitigated sewage impacts. And so now our control over sewage has really grown by leaps and bounds. So I think that's, as I understand it, that's been a major improvement in the Upper Bay.
Chris, what are the kinds of things have people done since the first Earth Day to sort of improve our relationship with what we dump into the ocean?
I think that policies have changed a lot in that time. And so we do see improvements to wastewater treatment, that kind of thing. And then just on the personal level, right? So people have started recycling. People are way more conscious about recycling now than they were then. Reducing impact through reducing the use of plastics, different things that are harmful to the environment. I think people have really taken a step back and realized that me as an individual can have an impact, and so I need to lessen that impact.
I know that I have to admit I'm older than you guys, and I can remember sitting in a becalmed sailboat and out of boredom tossing a can overboard to see how long it would take to sink.
Shame. For shame.
Well, we hope that if you were in that situation today, you wouldn't do the same thing.
I certainly would not. The ocean's all around us. I think the changes that are going on in the ocean, and they just work everywhere. I mean, because as you've mentioned, the zooplankton are part of the food chain, and some of those animals end up not being in the water.
Sure. I think on a very positive note too, I mean, it's worth realizing the oceans are a pretty big place. And so we get a lot of, in talking with students who like to focus on the doom and gloom of our interactions with the oceans. And I just think it's important to realize that there has been a lot of positive change in our interactions with the coastal ocean and the global ocean. It's important to sort of focus and appreciate that. And when you're out in the middle of the ocean on a very big research vessel, you get overwhelmed by how big the oceans are. And so while we do have impacts, and it's worth realizing that, it's also important to realize we've done a lot of good, and the oceans are a big place, something to appreciate.
It's almost like it's such a big place that, you know, if we don't trash it up too badly, if we reform our acts, it can reform itself as well.
I think that's the hope. That's the hope.
That's all you got for me? That's the hope? That's the hope?
That's all I've got, because, I mean, you never know. I mean, it's if you look at, this is also the anniversary of the Gulf oil spill, and a lot of what you see from news coverage and from the scientific work is that the impacts might not have been as bad as initially thought. There certainly are impacts, and there seems to be some suggestion that that fisheries are haven't been irreparably damaged. But again, you never know. There's still oil and fish tissue, and so I think it's any of these sort of acute impacts to the ocean are long-term questions, and we tend to not think very well long-term. We tend to think in the very short term, and a lot of these changes in the ocean and the coastal environments take some time to really come back. So I hope that our worldview of really short-term thinking doesn't get in the way of letting these systems get back to their original states or improve.
That ties back in with something we were talking about earlier, like, if you will, the life cycles, because, you know, we're used to a certain kind of life cycle being humans. Then you get these zooplankton that are in a 30-day kind of life cycle, some of them. And then you've got the ocean, which is in a geological kind of scale. I think very important for us to remember that there's that there is that relationship, that these all these little short-term things add up to bigger and bigger going up.
Those small-scale things that we think don't have an impact, they do scale up. And so when we think about the geological life cycle of the ocean, it's huge. And we've seen throughout nature over history that there is a cyclic nature to our environment. And so things recover in a given amount of time. It's just a matter of whether that impact is too great to recover in the normal amount of time.
And that's one of the things we do, I think, in our science that might not be appreciated as much as it could be. And that's that a lot of what we do is we quantify variability and we quantify change and we try to sort of bracket those things. And those are hard to get across to the public, I think, is that how much variability is there around some measurement and what does that mean for patterns of change? And so we're trying to do that with zooplankton in the bay, and we're trying to, my colleagues are trying to do that with atmospheric conditions and larger scale ocean processes. And so those are the kinds of things we do, which again, don't always convey to sort of the short-term issues that we tend to deal with.
Some of the pictures that are up at the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment website of zooplankton, all they look pretty scary creatures.
Once you magnify them, they do. Yeah, when you magnify them up, they have these sort of long antennae with sensory hairs, and they have these feeding appendages. Again, we were talking about the idea that these organisms are sort of swimming in a molasses-like sticky environment because they're so small, and so they're sort of squeezing that fluid through this array of filter feeding appendages, and it's just I wouldn't want one of them coming at me if I was their food.
If you were that size,
right? Little jaws and spiky legs.
And kids and adults, I mean, eat that kind of thing up. Is that these things are so adapted to their environment that to avoid a tiny little fish, it behooves the zooplankton to have a pretty big spike on the top of its head, and so kids love that, and that's a great way to get in the door, get your foot in the door with kids, is talk about their different adaptations and what they look like and why that is.
Tying in again with the Earth Day message, that's a great way of getting, well, until NASA finds us some aliens from outer space, you think of what lives in the ocean is a whole different kind of life than what us lung-breathing people are used to.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you brought up the deep sea research from the past too, and that's, if you look at the fish from the deep sea, they have these great big fangs and they're very striking, but if you actually sort of tap on those fangs, they're actually fairly brittle and they're more like cages for the organism. They're not sort of, it's not a saber-toothed tiger down there that's ripping apart food. They're actually fairly brittle teeth.
Oh, time out. Now you've got my attention again. You've really got my interest. What the heck would a large, ugly fish swimming around with flashlights at the end of its tentacles, what would it need a cage for?
Sure. So food doesn't come along all that often. And when it does, you want to make sure that you get it. And so the idea is you take a great big gulp out of whatever comes by, and you might even not just have a cage-like mouth. You might have an extensible stomach so that as soon as you ingest this huge fish that you just came across, it can't get away, and you store it in your stomach and you just dissolve it over time. So you take advantage of whatever you can get in this sort of food poor environment.
And can we back up and you mentioned ugly. I mean, why does it need to be ugly? I mean, right. You know, these things are amazing creatures down there that have the big jaws, little eyes, big eyes, long tails. I guess beauty really is in the eye of the beholder. I don't know.
Yeah. Because all those different features have a purpose.
Yes, right. Absolutely.
And students really, really react well to that, and also non-student members of the public, I guess. We have these animals in jars, essentially, the samples from cruises, and when you bring them out and sort of lay them on the table, it's really just a striking thing to look at, where you have some animals, as you said, with these sort of feather-like appendages with great big light bulbs on the end. You have others with great big teeth, others with monstrously large eyes, and then you get a chance to talk about that. They're really striking and just different from one another as well as from us, for example.
Us land-based people are a little bit familiar with this with insects, but I think there's even wider variety in terms of the size and appearance of all these different critters that live in the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, they have to be specially adapted, and they evolve over time to have these different features. And what they're dealing with at the bottom of the ocean is completely different than what, you know, the average insect or bird is dealing with up here on land. So over eons, these things have developed, and they have a purpose.
I think one of the things that we're increasingly realizing about the oceans, too, is it's not just a big glob of water, right? So this cube of water actually has structure to it, and there might be turbulence, little strings of turbulence in it, and food might be in filaments. It's not just uniformly distributed in a square meter of water. And so I think we're understanding more and more that there's actually little niches within this pelagic or open ocean water habitat that organisms can be adapted to or can utilize, much like in a forest where you might have some insects that are living on the bark of a tree, some are living in the leaf litter, some are living on the leaves. And so there are different places, even in sort of just a seemingly homogeneous square of water.
I had not thought of that. Now, I have a brother-in-law who's a recently retired marine biologist, and he used to study schools of fish and, you know, currents. And to me, that was the kind of thing you looked at, was these big scale things, you know, hundreds of thousands of fish in a school and where they go. But you just brought it down to a square meter or a square foot.
Sure. And we go to these scientific meetings and you see people put up model simulations of again, turbulence in this little chunk of water. And this just happened to me recently. I was just blown away thinking about, at that really small scale, there's a lot of variability that these organisms can sense and be affected by. And so, you know, there's a lot to do and a lot to think about. And it's across a very, very large spatial and temporal scale, both space and time.
This discussion has been fascinating. I really hope it helps all of our listeners take an understanding of how important it is that we all recognize all the different parts of our environment, including the parts that John Cohen studies deep down in the dark ocean and way up north in the cold ocean. And Chris, as the Marine Advisory Service agent, give us a pitch, man.
You do your part, right? So whether that's driving less, making sure you recycle, using less plastics, plastic bags, all that kind of thing, do your small part, and that will add up greatly.
The more you learn about the ocean and its creatures, the more you learn to appreciate all of our interaction.
Yes. With knowledge comes appreciation.
Guys, this has been way too much fun.
He says with sarcasm.
No, this is really great. Thank you so much, Chris Petrone.
Thank you.
And thank you so much, John Cohen.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.